All right. Well, I'm already recording, so let's go. Hey, everybody. Matt Belknap is with me this week. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In your place.
Yeah.
We did this last time when Jimmy was on the show. And I'm sorry I'm late.
That's fine.
I'm the worst person. But you're the first person to, like, pick Stephen Wright and then stick with it. Some people are like, oh, I like maybe Stephen Wright, but then they don't feel confident to speak on him, which I think is funny.
Well, I'm not a comedian, so I don't feel like I'm not in, there's no, like, the stakes are very low for me to, like, pick whatever, you know. This is just an album. When I was thinking about doing your show, I was just thinking about, like, what album have I listened to the most in my life, and, like, the ones that I, that came to mind were, Eddie Murphy's Comedian, which is kind of like the audio version of Delirious. Dennis Miller's The Off-White album, and this one. And then I think there's one Bill Cosby album, and I always forget which one it was, but it was just the one that I had as a kid that I listened to a zillion times. But this one, like, I don't know, like, it probably is the one I listened to the most growing up. And I got to see Stephen Wright. Like, my dad took me to see him, like, three different times when I was, like, between the ages of 12 and 15, probably. It was just something that my dad and I shared, so it was kind of special. We both, like, we don't really have the same sense of humor, but we both loved Stephen Wright, so it was kind of like that was one place where we could meet. My dad loves him, still loves him, he still quotes him and stuff. So it was just a nice, I don't know, it was just a nice thing. But I hadn't listened to it before this. I just listened to it today. I hadn't listened to it in 20, 25 years, probably.
Wow.
Or more. I don't even know the last time. It might have been the 80s still. So it was super interesting to go back and listen to something that I literally had the entire thing memorized when I was a kid. And I was, like, curious to see, you know, if it held up and I kind of feel like it does. I still love the way he looks at the world, which doesn't seem as unique as it did back then. I mean, I was a kid, so it was like I had a different perspective on it. He kind of introduced me to the idea of, he was my introduction to sort of like a surrealist, like, comedic perspective and absurd, just being absurd.
Right.
That and The Far Side, which I always think of them together.
I could see that.
The Far Side was huge in the 80s. I don't know if everyone remembers that comic strip, but it was very similar to Stephen Wright and his very off-kilter sensibility. I loved both of those things. And so, yeah, it was like, I still have a place in my heart for that stuff. So
of course, it was
fun to listen to again.
Did you see him on TV first? Where did you find out that he existed?
I have no idea. Yeah. I was too young. I didn't have cable at that age. This came out in 85, and I think I probably got it in 86 or something.
Okay.
I honestly think my dad probably just bought it for me, or he bought it for himself maybe, and then I got to listen to it. We had it on cassette, and yeah, I mean, it's so weird. I never really thought about it. I just remember listening to these things, but I never really thought about the fact that, like, how they got into the house, or they weren't, like, purchased for me.
Right.
It was, like, something that my dad would buy and listen to in the car or something, and then I kind of would grab it and take it away and listen to it. So, yeah, I think for whatever reason, he bought it. I don't know what brought him to it.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Wright, you probably know, I know now, I didn't know then, was, you know, had one of the most amazing Tonight Show sets of all time. And you can see that. There's a documentary about the Boston comedy scene where they talk about that moment where Johnny brought him over to the couch, and it's just like he went from being no one, like a weirdo that nobody really knew, to being a nationally famous comedian.
And that
really, what's interesting to me about him is, like, that's really all he ever was. Like, he has this weird career where, like, he actually won an Oscar for a short film he made.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I think even before this album that happened. But yeah, or maybe it was after. I don't know when it was. But he won an Oscar for best live action short at some point in the 80s. But basically, he was a touring comedian and just a really successful one. I'm sure people tried to put him on TV, like make a TV show, like build a TV show around him. Maybe he probably had some minor film roles that I don't really remember any. But he just was a guy who was unique and super funny and great at writing these jokes that were very specific to him. And that was his job, and he went out and did it. I don't know. There's something kind of cool about that, where, like, he didn't go off and do other things and leave stand-up behind. It was just, this was his career, and he's still, I think he's still doing it as far as I know.
Yeah. It's interesting to talk to, because sometimes if you talk to, obviously, I mean, you know, you talk to some stand-ups, and it's clearly a bridge to elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
to something else.
Right.
To the next TV project. Some of them stick with stand-up as either, well, this is always going to be my fallback, or I genuinely love it.
Yeah.
You know, so it is interesting. I think he's a very funny guy on screen,
mm-hmm.
but, and I think magnetic too, because otherwise you wouldn't want to listen to this, even with the quote unquote monotone. There's more to it than just simple monotone.
Yeah.
You know,
that's something that I was remembering listening to it, because I listened to the album a bunch before I ever saw him. And then mm-hmm. my dad took me to see him, and, I couldn't believe how, well, that's weird. Sorry about that.
That's right.
That was it. Oh, that must have been you calling. Sorry, you can edit that. like, I didn't realize, listening to it, there's a few things on the album that are maybe vaguely visual. Like, you hear it and you go, oh, I guess something he did something there. But, mm-hmm. you know, but I was amazed when I finally saw him. It was like every joke had like a visual punctuation to it, just a gesture or a look.
That's awesome.
And I was like, oh my God, there's a whole other level to his comedy that I didn't know about because I never saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like so amazing to me. And like, and then when I was listening to it today, I realized that there are a few moments where you hear sort of like a secondary laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, right. Cause that's when he would make that face, or he would sort of make that gesture. And that's really funny that I never knew that until I saw him.
Right. Right.
So like, I just, and that's something like Ryan, my partner at AST Records, and I talk about a lot, like how much you can get away with visual stuff on an album.
Yeah.
Because we always, you know, comics sometimes are like, oh, well, I can't do that. Or should I do this? And we're just like, well, I mean, my favorite albums all had stuff like that.
Yes.
Like where I was like, sometimes it was just kind of fun to imagine what they might be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like that. I mean, I guess if it's like every other joke has that going and you can't really understand it without it, that gets annoying. But
for sure. For sure.
But I lied a little bit of that. I don't know. I think it's kind of magic, because you just, then you have this thing in your head, and then someday you maybe get the chance to find out that what you were picturing wasn't even correct.
Right.
You had a whole different joke in your head, maybe.
I'd rewritten him in my head as a one-liner guy.
Yeah.
And that's not really true. There are many stories throughout it.
Yeah.
Two-liners, usually, actually, for most of them.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. It's weird. Like, I think because of his, for his time, he was very much a one-liner, like it's seemingly a one-liner mm-hmm. guy, because the sort of conventional stand-up that was proliferating in the mid-80s was not as succinct as what he was doing. But yeah, and actually, it's funny you say that, because I also think, like, he does weave these stories here and there. And the other thing I was realizing how it's like, the stuff that the jokes are really like almost cinematic sometimes, where mm-hmm. like just like one joke creates a whole scene in your head. Like, yes. You can imagine this being a scene in a movie, which I think is amazing. And that's kind of cool, especially for a guy who's known, like you said, for being sort of monotone and minimal. But what I was going to say is, like, I sometimes felt like listening to it again, I was like, oh, you know what? Like, some of these quote unquote stories are just like an excuse to string three or four one-liners together
right.
without it being too much of the same throughout mm-hmm. the whole album. And like, as a production, I'm really like kind of amazed by, first of all, it's very hard to do 40 minutes or 45 minutes of this kind of comedy. I think like
mm-hmm.
I've known a lot of comedians who are great. But like as they were starting out, they sort of were one-liner type comics.
Yeah.
And it was always interesting to see them run into that wall of like we were talking about Jim Hamilton.
Yeah.
Yeah, whose album Ryan and I produced. And it's the same thing, like great joke writer, mostly one and two-liners.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always like, how do you do this for 40 minutes
yeah.
without it getting really like repetitive and kind of boring.
Right.
The jokes have to do that so much more.
Mm-hmm.
But this album, like, they put that song in the middle.
Yes. Yeah, that's
really smart. There's a couple of like more story, and I even remembered before I started listening to it, I was like, my recollection is that there's a couple of like more story jokes toward the end, just to kind of bring you like the thing about getting on the elevator and the guy up in Phoenix, and then he goes to the house. Again, that's just kind of like, to me, an excuse to have a bunch of jokes.
Of course.
That just needed, you know, to go in one place. But and then the song is also just one-liners about a girlfriend.
Yes,
so
right.
They all just, they're sort of all thematically linked, but you could do that. He could do those separately and it would still work. But I love that some thought went into like, how are we going to structure this to make it to give it the maximum impact and not have people feel like it's just joke. And I'm sure I'm sure he had to figure that out for himself on the road too. But I feel like they did a great job of just assembling it so that you never really get bored.
I was arrested today for scalping low numbers at the deli. Sold a number 3 for $28. I was once walking through the forest alone and a tree fell right in front of me and I didn't hear it. I used to be a narrator for bad mimes. I live in a house that's on the median strip of a highway. Very nice grassy area, I like it. The only thing I don't like about it is when I leave my driveway, I have to be going 60 miles an hour. I have a microwave fireplace. I can lay down in front of the fire for the evening in 8 minutes.
It takes turns. Like, there's the top of it is all kind of like a lot of like, well, throughout the album, one thing that struck me that I didn't really think about as a kid probably was how much of his material is about like the law and like parking and driving. So much of it is like really like he's really like obsessed with like parking laws and like moving violations and court and jury duty. Like, if there's, but like especially at the top of the album, that's like a chunk of just like all that, and it's kind of amazing that he's just like, I'm just gonna put all that stuff together,
right?
And like he wasn't scared about like people going, wait, all these jokes are about this, but they're not. That's not because it's all, that's the track title or something,
for sure. Yeah,
it's just kind of like you're just. I mean, like the thing that's so fun about him is that you're just kind of taking, his comedy is just you're just strolling through his mind basically,
right,
and finding out like how he sees the world, and
mm-hmm.
And so that's what he was thinking about, I guess, when he wrote this stuff, but it's, I mean, it's cool because it's, when you think about it, not that this was his intention either, but like when you think about how do you bridge the gap, like if you're kind of an offbeat type thinker and like it's, people perceived him as being weird, like him and Emo Phillips were kind of like the weird guys.
That's true. Yeah.
But when you look at like what he's actually talking about, it's very relatable stuff. Like he's hitting all the sort of like the things, the commonalities of human life, but just from his perspective. So it's like, it's actually, I think that's why it works so well, is because everyone related to what he was saying. They just had never thought about those things the way he was thinking about them.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
So I mean, that didn't occur to me either as a kid, but it's like he wasn't really that weird. Like his take was weird, but his concerns were very, very, like, you know, sort of universal, I guess.
100%. One of my favorite, the whole time I was listening, I'm like, you know, I'm gonna write down my favorite joke, which, you know, of course becomes impossible because these are all, again, in my head, he's also a man of a perfect 5 minutes on anything I'd ever seen him on.
Right.
And then listening to a good 8 5-minute strung together is fantastic. But, the details he puts in there to make it seem like a real story that could have happened and still giving you this surreal punchline, like the bit about being on the bus, and he gives us a detail that the girl he's going to hit on as the punchline, she's an Asian girl, she's beautiful. Asian has nothing to do with it, but that detail, that aside, is so perfect to make it seem like, well, it must have really happened. Well,
what's funny about that is that in itself was a joke then that doesn't even really play as a joke anymore, mm-hmm. because he says, I saw a beautiful blonde-haired Asian woman.
Yes, right.
And the crowd laughs.
Yeah.
But like in 2015, it's like, well, plenty of Asian women have dyed blonde hair, mm-hmm. so I don't know. Like, that's not even that unusual.
You're right.
But at the time, it's like, oh, that's so weird and unusual. Mm-hmm. But that's almost just like a little detail that he can get a laugh on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a it's a good joke. I was actually listening to it. I was like, I kind of feel like this is like a perfect comedy album. So mm-hmm. I was like, I wonder if there's any jokes that just don't work anymore.
Right.
And I was like, listening to it, the only one that really stuck out to me was when he says, he's talking about, it's a sort of tag to another joke. So the other joke, even though it doesn't matter, I'll tell it. I was at the museum and I accidentally walked into the women's room, mm-hmm. and everyone was furious. And I said, I'm sorry, I thought this was an exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
And then everyone laughed. And then he goes, women, can't live with them, can't shoot them.
Yeah, right.
And people erupt in cheers and laughter. I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
Right.
But I guess at the time, that was just kind of like a crazy thing to say. Now it's just kind of like a street joke, basically.
True.
And not even like a joke. It's just a really offensive, strange thing to say.
Yes, right, right.
But it just maybe because it technically is a play on can't live with him, can't live without him. People were like, what? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And it is like kind of outrageous at the time. I guess it would be outrageous. But maybe it's just that sort of honestly, that sounds like a bumper sticker. Like I was like, I guess that phrase is so embedded in our culture now that doesn't even sound like comedy. It just mm-hmm. is like a thing that people say, mostly terrible people would say that.
Right.
I was like, man, that's rough. Like, that's weird that he says that. And I was almost like, but then I was also thinking, like, the crowd is, right away listening to it, I was like, kind of like amazed at the crowd. Like, you can hear that it's like a rowdy crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, like, I was trying to imagine, like, I don't know, where did he tape this?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, too. I don't know if it was in Boston or not.
I feel like it was, I want to say it was, like, Toronto or some crazy thing. I don't know why I think that, but
yeah,
let's see, it'll probably say here. No, San Francisco.
All right, then.
Except for that one bit with the guitar was in Chicago.
Okay.
But man, of all places, San Francisco, which is usually like, well, at least now, mm-hmm. like they're like the most, if you talk to any comedian, they're like, oh man, San Francisco. Like uptight, they'll like hiss and, and get like they'll tighten up about anything's like vaguely offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, this crowd is going crazy for like a woman shooting joke.
Right, right.
So that's strange. Odd. But like I just listened to it. I mean, like it's like a rowdy club crowd who are just like whooping and whistling and like applause breaking things weirdly that like mm-hmm. seem like it's like a weird reaction to certain jokes.
Yeah.
Not that they aren't funny, but it's just like it's. There's one point where he says, oh, what's the joke? I want to try to see if I can remember the actual joke. I think it might have been the joke where he says I was in Vegas and got into a heated argument over what I consider an odd number. And people are like, woo! And then you hear this one dude. It might not be this joke, so uh-huh. I apologize if I'm wrong. But it's one joke. This guy goes, touche, touche.
Is that what he says? Okay, I
like,
heard that
in
too.
In the crowd.
I heard that, yeah.
It's like what fucking bonkers that's happening on an album. I don't know. I don't really feel like you hear. It's not he's not really heckling, but
no.
It's like a real, nowadays, like, albums are recorded, if they're in a club, it's mm-hmm. like the crowd knows it's an album recording
for
and
sure.
they're on their best behavior,
mm-hmm.
or it's a theater, or it's like, you know, like a black box where everybody's like a fan and they know what's up. And,
yeah.
You know, that's sort of how it works, at least for what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And this is clearly not the way that
no.
was made at all,
no.
which I think is kind of amazing.
Yeah, and I wonder if it was smaller. Like, I don't know the size of the club where he was recording. I can't tell by listening to it either, but...
I don't even think that exists. I've never heard of that. I don't know if it exists anymore. Hmm. Wolfgang's.
And I even look... You know, the funny thing is, too, like, it's weird what the cover art does of this for me.
Mm-hmm.
The other cover art with the actual black and white.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It does, in my brain, it does make him stand out, but at the same time, kind of makes it just in my brain. He's just awash with this, just like...
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on with him. It's a perfect blank slate thing.
Yeah. Well, it's also very, like, he has a joke about you know, I packed up my Salvador Dali painting of two blindfolded dental hygienists trying to draw a circle on an Etch-a-Sketch. Right. And, like, I feel like, I don't think I knew who Salvador Dali was when I was a kid, but he's basically the Salvador Dali of comedy. Yeah, yeah. Like, he's doing the same thing. And so, like, the cover, if people don't know, it's like this weird wavy checkerboard pattern, like, behind him and on under. It's like a floor to wall sort of, you know, it's like he's inside a warped chessboard, basically.
Yeah.
And he's just sitting on a stool. And yeah, I mean, it is kind of letting you know, like, everything, the marketing of him was all about, this guy's weird, right. This guy's not normal.
Sure.
Which I think that was a very 80s thing, too. It's like, most comedy was just like, hey, I'm just like you, let me make some mm-hmm. jokes about it. And he was like, he was just like, I'm not at all like you, I'm a mental case,
yeah.
But it's still funny. And like, people were laughing, like I said, with him and Emo.
Yeah.
Just like laughing at what a weird guy, and like, oh, but like, it's awesome. I like, you can hear people in the crowd, you can hear their minds being blown by jokes. And that's such a cool thing to have captured, like, just that, like, secondary laughter of people getting it and mm-hmm. then just like losing their shit over like what he's like what he just did.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't, you know, it doesn't come off as mind blowing now. It's just kind of, it's just jokes.
Sure.
But I think at the time it was just like such a unique you know, left turn approach to comedy.
Yeah, I mean, especially with, obviously, you know, everybody considers Mitch Hedberg sort of the second Stephen Wright,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
In a lot of ways. So I guess that style became a thing you could do,
mm-hmm.
And clearly is a thing you can do if you put your own spin on it. But I mean, to do it with essentially known character, I don't want to say that because he's a good actor and he's very funny, very presentational, but
right.
with this kind of blank slate that he seems to be,
mm-hmm.
And also that he didn't have to do what Emo did.
Right.
You know?
I know. That's honestly, I'm like one of those people, my whole life I've been very, like, I guess, simple-minded in my approach to, like, I always see everything as like a binary, like, I love this and hate that. And like, so it's just like, I like Nikes and I hate Adidas, or like, I love Macs and I hate PCs, or whatever. And with Stephen Wright, I was like, I loved Stephen Wright and I did not like Emo Phillips at all. I always thought his delivery as a kid, I found it grating. I have since realized he's a genius. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're both geniuses, and I wish I had been more open-minded when I was a kid, because
right.
his jokes, his writing is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I got to see him live last year and it was great. Oh, but yeah, something, you know, his delivery felt like it was putting too fine a point on the like weird angle for me.
Sure.
Whereas, like you said, I agree with you. Like, Stephen Wright was basically just like a complete like monotone, like basically like turning down the level on everything other than the writing.
Yes.
Like, which I think is why I liked him, because I think I was just like really like a joke purist. Like, I really love great joke writing, and that's what like stood out so much with him. Is just it's just the ideas. That's all he has, basically. It's just these weird ideas that are so like so clever.
I told her I knew when I was gonna die because my birth certificate has an expiration date on it. Decided to leave and go to California, so I packed up my Salvador Dali print of two blindfolded dental hygienists trying to make a circle on an Etch-a-Sketch. And I headed for the highway and began hitching. Within 3 minutes, I got picked up by one of those huge trailer trucks carrying 20 brand new cars. Climbed up the side of the cab and I opened the door, and the guy said, I don't have much room in here, why don't you get in one of the cars in the back? So I did. And he was really into picking up people because he picked up 19 more. We all had our own cars. Then he went 90 miles an hour, we all got speeding tickets.
What's funny too, though, is mixed in with that. Well, like you say, they're well written, so to the point where a lot of them feel like vaudeville perfect. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I know that vaudeville is dated, but they feel like silly, goofy mm-hmm. vaudeville jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
Except with a modern twist, a modern take, and these just absurd angles. It would be as if Salvador Dali decided to do vaudeville.
Yeah.
Just to bring that further.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. There, it's like, I mean, the structure is obviously super classic. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't get more straightforward than just, like, set up punch.
Sure.
You know, that's all. That's mostly all he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's cool is I'm always, like, obviously, again, none of this occurred to me at the time, but like when I look back on things that I've enjoyed comedy wise, film wise, music wise, I always like the stuff that's really stripped down and simple, but like really wonderfully original and which is well written, well crafted, but within a very simple shell, you know, like it doesn't need to be dressed up. It doesn't need to be fancy. You know, like I usually shy away from stuff that I feel like is like trying to distract you from the fact that the substance of it isn't all that special.
Yeah.
And that's so to me, Stephen Wright is like the ultimate example of like no window dressing at all, just great jokes.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
And at the time, I mean, there was plenty to be distracted by, and you know, we don't need to necessarily bring up any names, but there are plenty of comedians for whom the polish was everything.
Yeah.
So it still surprises me that this is 85, I think, because in my own life, I think I heard of him so much later, but,
I think I'm right about that. Let me double check this.
I think you're right. That's what I thought I saw earlier today as well when I was researching it.
Yeah. Like I said, I have no idea when this came into my life at all, but,
I think you mentioned before recording too, but what you have is, while not the vinyl, does come with a DVD, but is entirely unrelated, which is really funny.
This is the 30th anniversary.
Okay.
I'm sorry. 20th anniversary. Right now, as we're talking, it's the 30th anniversary. This came out 10 years ago and is, and includes this sort of quasi sequel that he did on Comedy Central in 05. It was like his first special since this one, basically.
So crazy.
Yeah, and it's also really good. I remember watching it on Comedy Central. And he's, you know, it's all new jokes. Still his style, still really funny. You know, doesn't necessarily do anything, you know, groundbreaking, but it's just more Stephen Wright. And I was like, great, sign me up for that.
Right.
It doesn't say actually what year this is, but I'm pretty sure when I was... importing this into my computer earlier, it said 85, and I'm gonna take their word for it for some reason.
Well, you know, it's funny too, so many comedians talk about, because if you're gonna do this for your lifetime, you're going to be philosophical about it. Mm-hmm. They do talk about the need, or at least their own internal need, to develop and evolve. For him, I feel like it's probably just, I need to just make sure I'm a better joke writer or the best joke writer I can be. He doesn't have to change. He's not the Madonna of comedy. He doesn't need to be.
Yeah. Well, I actually think it's super interesting that he never really made another album.
Yeah.
And like, like I said, I don't know what happened, you know, afterwards, but I know that I saw him, you know, over the course of 3 or 4 years in the 80s. And there must have been some new material sprinkled in here and there, but basically, like, he had like an hour of great stuff, and he basically just was like, this is me, like, and then I think obviously because he did that thing in 05, like, he obviously had more that he came up with, but unlike, you know, it's now very, you know, like the Louis C.K. thing or whatever, of like having a new hour every year. He's like the other end of the spectrum. He's just like, this is my work, like, this is my thing that I'm gonna take around the world and share with people.
Yeah.
And the thing that's super I don't remember ever being like, I saw him, like I said, I saw him 3 times, mostly doing the same material. I don't remember ever once thinking, those jokes again. Like, it was like a rock show where you would just like go to hear the stuff that you loved. Like, I wanted to hear the greatest hits. And like, that's how the crowds were. Like, everybody knew the album, everybody knew the jokes for the most part. I don't know. Like, I feel like in a weird way, they're funny every time. And, you know, like, they're not, they don't really. They may initially work on some, like, surprise mechanism level, but I don't know. It's still fun to be reminded. I guess maybe because they're so portable that you can't remember necessarily all of them at once. So, like, there's always going to be one you're like, oh, right, that one, that's so funny. And, like, it's funny every time you think of it. And, like, you just kind of carry them with you, you know? Like, I think of listening to it, the one about like, you know, sometimes I like to fill up my bathtub and turn on the shower and pretend I'm in a submarine that's been hit. I probably thought of that 1,000 times in my life over the course, like whenever the drain gets stopped up in my shower and the water starts going up as you're showering, I think of that joke. And like, there's a lot of stuff like that. Like I remember for years and years, every time I would be on a highway and I would be like, just look like my, like, you know, my mind would wander and I would look at the median and I'd think about the idea that he, like that joke about, I have a house on the median strip of the highway and I the only problem is I have to go 60 miles an hour in my driveway to leave. And like, it's that, I like just things like that, like just seeing certain things will trigger those jokes in my mind. Mm-hmm. And it's just like a nice treat to have those jokes somewhere in your head that like, to me, they're like, I enjoy them every time I hear them or think of them. So
I remember again, on listening to this earlier today, I felt very smart remembering a punchline before it came up and I was super excited. Mm-hmm. And wait, did I remember this correctly? And I did. Bucky right. Goldstein is what he says, and I was just so excited.
Yeah.
So like, that is another thing too, is like, again, surprise notwithstanding, like
right.
there is that.
And that's another one where, like, that's like a, almost a street joke in the way
yeah.
that it's written. I mean, it is. Like, basically, you could find that in a joke book.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'm sure he wrote it, but, like, the style of it. You know, the other thing, I grew up in New England, not near Boston, like, on the other end, of, like, on the western side of Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
But like, the thing that never occurred to me at the time, that now that I hear him and you kind of hear the faint Boston accent, like, he's kind of beneath the weird like persona like of like this guy who everyone's like, oh, he's from another planet. Like, that was kind of the sort of collective agreement that we all had about Stephen Wright.
Right.
But he's also kind of just like a regular dude, like from Boston. Like, he's very, like, he kind of reminds me of like, you know, my uncle or my cousins, like, who, you know, are from New Hampshire or whatever. And,
mm-hmm.
and like, there's like, again, like, there's something very relatable and like sort of everyman about his clearly his concerns. Like, they're just very like mundane concerns. Like, he lives in an apartment and he's,
yeah.
you know, he's getting parking tickets and, you know, stuff like that. He has to go to jury duty. So it's all like, yeah, I mean, that's just like, what do we all have to deal with in life? And then like, but the difference is like, he has a Shetland pony in his apartment. And like, that's one of the few jokes that I was like, oh, I didn't get this joke when I was a kid. And
yeah.
now I get it. But when he said like, I forget how he gets into it. Something about the horse had got radiation or something, but all the hair fell out except for the tail. So now I rent it out to Hare Krishnas for birthday parties, which I didn't even know what that meant. But it's now it's like the image of that is so funny, like a bald horse with a tail.
It's amazing.
It's really funny.
So was this the first, I don't want to assume, but was this the first comedy album you heard as a kid? Or
no.
No, okay.
No. It was probably Bill Cosby or
okay, right.
maybe Woody Allen.
Like, stuff that your family introduced you to?
Yeah, that was just in my dad's collection, and I just, you know, I just put them on one day. But yeah, so by the time this came along, I had, you know, I sort of had an interest in stand-up from those, although I didn't probably even know that it was called stand-up, or I don't know what I thought of it, but I just
sure.
knew that I liked it. And like, I would listen to, basically I listened to the Bill Cosby album. It's the one with the dentist bit on it, so I don't
mm-hmm.
again, I don't remember what it's called, but I listened to it as many times as it took to memorize the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then and so I guess my dad realized that like it was something that I was, oh, and then I would, you know, drive my family crazy by like reciting the jokes to them like in the kitchen or whatever.
Of course.
So yeah, so I guess maybe there was partly that. I guess my dad, I mean, obviously he bought them for his own reasons, but he also probably thought like, oh, Matt seems to like this stuff. So, and this is a clean album. That's the
mm-hmm.
other funny thing about it. Like, I don't know how I got my hands on the Eddie Murphy one, but like probably not by my parents' consent.
Yeah.
But this is something that my dad probably listened to. He was like, oh, this is totally fine. Like, he can listen to this. There's nothing weird about it. There's like some vague sexual references.
Right.
But there's, I don't think
it.
There's any swearing, which is also kind of amazing.
Right now I'm having amnesia and deja vu at the same time. A friend of mine named Dennis, his parents are midgets. But he's not a midget. He's a midget dwarf. He's this big. He's the guy who poses for trophies. I used to work for the factory where they make hydrants, but you couldn't park anywhere near the place. I used to be a proofreader for a skywriting company. I'm entering the Stranger Sweepstakes. It's a contest. You pay 50 cents and you get a little card that has a number on it. Then you go up to any stranger and you scratch a penny on his head. If the number under there matches the number you have, you win $100. I won twice. I was beat up 11 times.
He doesn't have any crutches. He's so pure, like not just clean language wise, but like very pure work.
Yeah. I mean, the guitar thing, like, he doesn't need that.
No.
I think it's really just like, I mean, it's a fun change of pace. And so maybe in some ways you could say that it's necessary to keep things, you know, from getting too monotone. But, but again, those jokes are still like, he could have put any jokes into them.
Right.
But with a guitar backing and would have worked.
It feels like a weird producer note. But I don't know how albums were recorded at that point.
Yeah.
You know? Especially if it was from one particular show where that comes from.
Yeah.
You wonder if that's the only time he did it. But
I remember him bringing the guitar
out
when I saw him. Yeah, like that was always part of it.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't always do the same thing, I don't think.
Okay,
But yeah, it also is oddly, for an album that isn't, there's no real sincerity to anything he's saying. But that chorus is not a joke chorus. He's singing a very sort of simple, heartfelt thing about a woman, and that's, I don't know, it's odd. It's like, that's one of the oddest things that happens on the album when you think about it, like that he's just singing a love song kind of, and the crowd doesn't really know what to do with it. They're like, you can hear some titters, like, is this supposed to be funny that he's singing now instead of telling a joke? But it's just kind of like, he's just saying, I wish you were here. Like, that's it. And it's kind of great.
There are a lot of interestingly worded setups, too, that get laughs, premature laughs. You can hear a lot of that, too.
The
audience is so ready.
Yeah, they're so, especially at the top of it, it's like, they're, like, so out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first started listening, I was like, I don't know if I can, like, I don't know why I never noticed it as a kid, but, like, it was, like, almost distracting. Like, sorry, I was like, oh man, I hope they calm down, because I don't want to listen to the whole album of these people being like this crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm sure from their perspective, it was like, hey, that was a great show. The crowd was going crazy.
So how old were you when you saw him live then?
I was probably 12 or 13.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect.
It wasn't too long after this came out, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I think that was, I know that that was like that period, like 6th, 7th, 8th grade. Maybe a little ninth grade. That's when my dad and I started going to a lot of, as basically we lived in, like I said, Western Mass, upstate New York, like right on the border of New York and Massachusetts. And so we had to drive to Albany, which is 45 minutes away, mostly to see shows. But then there was this weird venue in Lenox, Massachusetts, that started having summer like series, and like Carlin and Seinfeld and Andrew Dice Clay and like all these insane people came. I think maybe Paul Reiser.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to everything.
That's
when that
amazing.
Happened. But I, and Stephen Wright. But I saw Stephen Wright in Albany for the first time, and I saw Robin Williams in Troy or one of those cities.
God, that's amazing.
When I was 10, that was that was the first show I went to.
What club did you see? Do you remember where you saw him? Where in Albany, Stephen Wright?
It was a theater.
Oh, it was a theater. Okay.
I think so, yeah. I don't remember. I wonder if my dad remember. I haven't lived there in 30 years or for 25 years, so I don't really, I don't know the venues anymore.
Yeah.
I know a couple of the names. I think I saw Robin Williams at like the RPI Fieldhouse, which is like the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Like that's like where their basketball team plays or whatever. It's like huge, you know, it's like a 10,000 seat arena or something.
Right.
And that was nuts.
I bet.
That was like a and out of control. Like, that was amazing. But yeah, Stephen Wright, it was a theater in Albany. I should ask, I'm going to ask my dad. That's a good question. I'm curious now.
Was that the beginning, though, of live comedy for you, period? At that point, was it irresistible?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't get, you know, it was like, I couldn't go all the time. I didn't live anywhere where I could go to a club.
Yeah.
The Boston was probably the closest place with clubs, and we didn't really go to Boston much. It was 2 hours away. But, but anytime there was anybody that was at all interesting, my dad would take me, or, you know, it became a big deal for us, both. I think he really enjoyed doing it too. And then he started going to, like, because he would be on the road for work a lot, just driving around New England and New Jersey. And he just started going to, like, because this is back when, like, every hotel lounge would have comedy in it, because there was just comedy was exploding. And so he saw some ridiculous shows. He actually got me, when I was like 16 or 17, he gave me this like a comedy club flyer, literally from a hotel lounge. And it was signed by Jim Carrey. He saw a show with Judd Apatow and Jim Carrey.
Shit.
And Judd Apatow, like, opening for Jim Carrey in like 90 or 91 or something. Awesome. And I still have that. He's like, Jim Carrey wrote it to me. So
fantastic.
He got way into it. And, and obviously, yeah, I was way into it too.
Sure.
But when you're a kid, it's kind of like, at least for me, I didn't think I could, you know, like, my whole life was dictated by school and stuff. So, like, I wasn't like, oh, I'm just going to start going to all the comedy I can.
Right.
Like, it didn't really occur to me. It was just a thing that I loved to do when I got the chance to do it. But it didn't seem like a thing that I could really... the main thing was, and I still feel this way to some extent, which is why I'm not a comedian. It always struck me as something that you, like, it was not a human endeavor. Like, I didn't think that Stephen Wright or Robin Williams were doing something that I could ever do. Like, I was like, oh, they're clearly a different species than I am.
Sure.
And so they can do this. It was like watching magic to me, like, just something that didn't, like, I didn't understand how they could do it, but I loved seeing it. So,
yeah.
And that pretty much held true for most of my life. It's like, oh yeah, I understand it a lot better now, but I still feel like it's like something that you have to be built a certain way to be able to do it.
What about the enjoyment of breaking it down? Because obviously at least you have a mind for the mechanics of comedy. Do you have that? But you have an interest in sitting and thinking about it a lot.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's
some people hate that shit.
Yeah, no, I know.
I love it.
A lot of people hate me for doing it, but because I ran the website, A Special Thing, which was that the way I sort of got back into comedy as an adult was going to shows at M Bar in the early mid 2000s, when Comedy Death Ray was starting, and then just going to whatever I could find that would be funny.
Yeah,
and I would write recaps of the shows that I was seeing, and that's how I met Jimmy Pardo, who I do this podcast with, Never Not Funny, in case anyone's not aware of what I'm talking about. And that's how I met everybody I know in comedy. I basically met because I was this weirdo on a website
that's
writing
awesome.
Recaps of live shows. And like, I was kidding, but not kidding, where a lot of people didn't appreciate that I was sort of breaking down comedy. But it was like, I was doing it at that time because I was trying to become, I wanted to be a screenwriter, and I had sort of figured out that I liked writing comedy, and I was trying to, like, basically, yeah, I was trying to deconstruct it, like, take it apart and to figure out how it all worked, and so that I could do it myself. And I just got way sidetracked with that and never really went back to the writing part. I was more interested in, like, being a part of it somehow, which is how I ended up starting this record label with Ryan.
That's insane, though. I mean, just to start from, well, to not, do, was it, at any point, was there the desire to do stand-up, or is it the whole time it was?
I initially, no.
Okay.
I never really, I wasn't like, I mean, I guess you could have said at one point, like, oh, well, you, like, that I wanted to do it, but mm-hmm. I just wasn't being honest with myself.
Okay.
Because yeah. there was an element of, like, I do, like, have something, a little bit of the performer mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did school plays growing up, and I, you know, at that time in my life, I was doing a fair amount of karaoke, which I think was, like, mm-hmm. a frustrated performer's oh, yeah. way of, like, getting on a stage somehow and having people pay attention to you. And also, like, I would just try to be funny when I did karaoke. That, and
sure.
I think that was also another example of a frustrated would-be comedian. But then I did eventually do open mics after I had already gotten pretty far into all this stuff. And I think it was before I started the label, but I was just kind of like, I think the way I rationalized it then was that I just wanted, if I was going to write about comedy so much and talk about it like I knew what I was talking about, mm-hmm. I should have that experience.
Yeah.
So I did like 6 months of open mics. And I didn't really, I just didn't get addicted to it. I think what I assume is the case for everyone who does it seriously is that they get addicted. And the alternative to that is that you don't. And so what that feels like, at least what it felt like for me, was just going up and either doing okay or, you know, open mics are, you know, kind of whatever because there's like six people and they're all mm-hmm. waiting for their turn. So it's not like you're going to get huge laughs. But
right.
I had good sets and it didn't feel like it. I didn't get high off of that. Like
sure,
I wasn't
sure.
like, oh wow, I got to chase that. Like I was 30 years old. And I just was like, that doesn't do enough for me to put up with the grueling nature of having to like
yeah.
go through the ranks. I think if there was any part of it that I wanted, it was just the part of it where I wanted to skip ahead to the part where I was good and everybody liked me,
yeah,
which
course.
Is obvious. Like that's what anyone would want.
Sure.
But I was like, well, maybe I think there's an outside chance that I could get decent at this over a long period of time, but I have no patience for going through the process because mm-hmm. I just don't enjoy it enough.
I got up this morning, I couldn't find my socks, so I called information. I said, hello, information? She said, yes. I said, I can't find my socks. She said, they're behind the couch. They were. I'm tired of calling up the movies and listening to that recording of what's playing, so I bought the album. Last time I went to the movies, I was thrown out for bringing my own food in. My argument was the concession stand prices are outrageous. Besides, I haven't had a barbecue in a long time. Went to the cinema, it said adults $5, children $2.50. I said, all right, give me two boys and a girl. One time I went to the drive-in in a cab. The movie cost me $95.
And then the next thing that happened really was that I started the label and Jimmy and I started Never Not Funny the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of became enough of a creative outlet for me where I didn't feel like I was. I think if I hadn't done either of those things, or especially the podcast,
mm-hmm.
I may have been like, well, I need to put this stuff somewhere.
Right.
Like I want to express myself in a comedic way, but
mm-hmm.
the podcast gave me a platform to do that.
Yeah.
I was able, I there was no pressure on me because I wasn't the comedian on the show. I was
mm-hmm.
just like the guy with the mixing board, but
mm-hmm.
but I could be funny if I had something funny to say.
Sure.
And I learned over years of doing it how to be a little better at that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that sort of fulfilled me creatively, so that I didn't ever really felt like I was missing anything by not going on stage.
It's satisfying to know that, oh, this isn't right for me, and I can move on without desperately clinging to something.
Yeah,
because it's
yeah.
really easy to do that.
Well, and like I don't I don't know. I think you can get into trouble trying to, like, sort of psychoanalyze comedians or, like, figure out what makes them do what they do. Mm-hmm. But I've known a fair number of comedians, and I think most of them would admit that it's not, like, necessarily coming from a really healthy place that they... The ones who need to get on stage, the ones mm-hmm. who, like, can't live without it.
Yeah.
I think they would all kind of say, like, yeah, that's not necessarily... the healthiest thing. I mean, doing it isn't unhealthy, but
right.
the need isn't necessarily something that they'd be like, well, yeah, this is totally great. It's because I'm a totally well-adjusted person.
Right.
And I'm not claiming I am a totally well-adjusted person either. I think everybody's kind of screwed up in different ways, and mm-hmm. the focus is put on performers because everybody's trying to figure out how they ended up doing such an unusual thing with their lives. Whereas if you just be like, well, guess what? Like, Bonnie in accounting's also kind of screwed up. But no one's like, oh, do you think that troubled childhood is why she's crunching numbers now?
Right.
Like, that's not... That no one, like, equates those things. But when you look at someone who's like, oh, they need attention, so they must be screwed up. I do think that's somewhat bogus because I think everybody, to some extent, a greater or lesser extent, wants... you know, everyone wants to connect with other human beings.
Of course, yeah.
That's kind of a basic human need. Some people just are more comfortable doing it in a situation where they have the mic.
Yes,
and everybody else has to just listen. And I like conversations. I mean, that's kind of why I like podcasts, is because mm-hmm. I actually like a little more back and forth. I think that's kind of fun. And I think you can still be funny doing that. It's a totally different thing.
For sure. I think the irony of that, too, the idea that... you know, what you're talking about is people judging somebody for being so screwed up or being so... the whole point of a stand-up is to reflect back at you the bullshit you're already feeling.
Yeah.
Express it for you.
Right.
Help you relax. And then immediately we jump to, well, they're very outgoing with their feelings.
Right.
The same feelings I'm having or somebody I know is having. It is very odd
to
pick that apart.
True.
When they're there for you.
Yeah, yeah, they're doing the hard, they're doing the work so that you don't have to in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like they're exploring the depths of their soul so that you can just like have a cathartic moment of realization without like, you know, being tortured by the. I mean, I think in some ways, performers of all different stripes are just, you know, usually just very sensitive people. They're
mm-hmm.
more in touch with their feelings and that they're like they have can access those more quickly and easily.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone's like that. Not everyone can just like go drill right down like that, but it is somehow it does resonate with you no matter who you are when you see someone touch on something that's like a real human basic truth. And like you know, I think that's kind of that's the service that comedians provide in a weird way. And also, all artists in different ways do that.
Sure.
Singers do that, and painters do that. Like, if you can look at a painting and be like, oh my God, I know what they meant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of amazing, too. But the comedy, it's just such a strip. Again, like I was saying before, like, all comedy in stand-up, at least, is pretty stripped down. There's,
mm-hmm.
there's not a lot of dressing to it. You're not, like, you can't really... I mean, there are tricks. Like, of course, there are ways to look sort of, like... get laughs that maybe aren't the most noble ways to do that.
Sure.
But it's still just a person and their voice
yeah.
and their ideas, and that's it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I feel like that's, I always liked the sort of the meritocracy of that, like that that you couldn't cheat. Although I think later on I realized, well, some people kind of do cheat, but in the abstract, at least there are fewer crutches to rely upon. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's like the, whereas with like making a movie, there's like a million different things you can do to distract people from the fact that you have nothing to say or that you're kind of, you know, not that, you know, talented or interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was kind of, I think that's why I gravitated to it.
What's interesting then is I'm curious what your, is a special thing just the people you like and then that's enough for you? You know, it's just like, I want to, because when you, at least every album release I've seen of yours, it is, you know, it sticks to that aesthetic. It's simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's nothing overblown.
Yeah.
They all just sound nice and the albums look good.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's always been the aesthetic for some people, but I don't know. It's again, they're very stripped down. Like, I have, mm-hmm. I went to Jonah Ray's recording of Hello, Mr. Magic Plane Person, mm-hmm. and I bought it. Two very simple, like, it was a small venue.
Yeah.
Quick recording.
Yeah.
Very polished, though, mm-hmm. and a white record and a white sleeve. Like, that's a very simple
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we usually defer to the artist on creative stuff.
Sure.
Like, I mean, we have our... If they ask our opinion, we have our opinion. And mm-hmm. yeah, that's Ryan and I always, we started, we met at M-Bar and going to the Comedy Death Ray show every week. And mm-hmm. so we just started out as fans who mostly just felt like, there's some amazingly talented comedians right now that aren't being heard outside of LA. And, mm-hmm. and like, we just wanted to help. That's what the website was too. The website was sort of, the point of it was to sort of share with people outside of LA what was happening here and yeah. like what's so great about it and try to explain why I thought it was so great.
Mm-hmm.
And the label was the same thing. It was just like, here's what we're being exposed to, and it's amazing. And so the starting point with stuff is usually like, record it and put it out and like, don't touch it, don't mess with it. That doesn't always, it rarely ever happens that it doesn't get touched at all. There's always some editing, but that's where our hearts are in terms of what we think comedy records should be like.
Yeah.
I don't think we would do a record with someone that we thought like needed a lot of, tinkering to make good.
Course.
You're absolutely right that we basically just work with people that we like and mm-hmm. like, there's plenty of them, so it's sure. like there's never a shortage of comedians.
I mean, it also makes good financial sense, too, to put on somebody who doesn't need all the work. I mean, if you want to, I mean, I know that's the crass side of it, I guess. But, I mean, you do have to, make a living.
Yeah.
What made you think that was a sane idea to start a record company, though? That does seem like a weird choice.
We didn't do it as a... We weren't doing it to make money.
Sure.
Like we did it as a hobby because mm-hmm. we thought it would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan used to be in a band, and he's a big fan of, punk music. And mm-hmm. and so he always kind of just wanted to start a record label of some kind.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to put these comedians out and have people hear them. So, yeah, there was no thought to, like... Mostly our thought was, like, can we make enough money on the first one to make another one and then just keep doing that
sure.
forever, basically.
Yeah.
And we did, because it's very cheap. It doesn't cost that much to make records.
Right.
So,
right.
Or at least CDs. Records do cost more money, sure. but we can also now luckily afford to press vinyl when we feel like it matters to do that or merits it. We're doing, we're just talking to Dave about doing Greg Proops' next album we're going to do on vinyl.
Really?
So, yeah.
Awesome.
And we just recorded that over New Year's. So that'll come out later this year, and that's going to be great. We also produce his podcast, so we're good friends. We've been working with him for years.
When I stayed up all night playing poker with Tarot Kearns. I got a full house and four people died. I have a telescope on the peephole on my door so I can see who's at the door for 200 miles. Who is it? Who is it gonna be when you get here? I got an answering machine for my phone now when I'm not home, and someone calls me up, they hear a recording of a busy signal. Lost a buttonhole.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like people just, it's great that actually comedy, like we exist for comedy fans. Like mm-hmm. that's kind of what we, we're not just like throwing these things into a bottomless pit. Like we know that there are a few people like us out in the world who love comedy and want to hear it. And luckily those people also like collecting things, and they like collecting vinyl has sort of become a even beyond like the actual listening to it. Cause I think most mm-hmm. people don't even listen to the vinyl. Right. They just like download it. but they like having that physical thing, and it is kind of a beautiful thing to, when you give a shit about comedy, mm-hmm. it's nice to have that to hold on to and to show off and display in your home or whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
I never, like, as a kid, I never got to experience that because I came of age in the cassette era.
Sure.
So everything was a cassette and then later CD, but I never had comedy records as a kid. I don't even know if my dad did. I feel like all of our comedy was on cassette. Maybe like one or two. But I don't remember. I mean, I remember listening to a few records that were like music, but
sure.
We are able to like sort of make a living doing it, mm-hmm. A little bit now. And, we sort of figure out how to work it so that it's, you know, it's not like super labor intensive. It's just, mm-hmm. It's still like a fun thing to do. Especially when you like the people that you're working with and you,
for sure.
You know, we still feel like these are people that deserve to be heard and we can help them do this sort of the little technical things that need to be done to get to an actual finished product. So we're happy to do it.
It's got to be kind of exciting too, to put something together and then maybe, I don't know how often if at all this happens, but you know somebody's work and then if you haven't been following them since you agree to make an album, and maybe they give you an hour of, holy shit, I've never seen this before, you just blew my... But to be able to have somebody email blow your mind.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's definitely... Well, I feel like there's some people who, you know, like Andy Kindler, mm-hmm. we've been working on this Andy Kindler record.
Yeah,
and it's an amazing set. And I feel like there's certain elements of it that I'd seen before, but mm-hmm. like... One of the weird things about being in LA is you don't usually get to see someone do a headlining set. Like, you can.
Yeah, yeah.
There are times when that happens. But mostly you see people doing, like, 10-minute sets around town.
Mm-hmm.
So, but to see Andy do that, and a lot of it was just like, it was so awesome to just watch him do that. Because he's one of these guys, like, actually, I think Greg is one of these guys, too. Who and definitely Jimmy is one of these guys because Jimmy he's 60% of his act is improvised.
Mm-hmm.
So, but all three of those guys, I always feel like I don't really ever know. You don't know what you're gonna get.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you're gonna get some stuff that's like material, quote unquote.
Sure.
But you're also just on a given night. It's like you have no idea where it's gonna go.
Yeah.
Even within the structure of a pre-written thing, you don't necessarily
right.
know where it's gonna go. Especially with Andy, like it's just and then Greg, I think. Ryan, I didn't get to go to his taping because it was in San Francisco, but Ryan was telling me, like, he riffed something on the first night. He taped, like, a couple of nights. And by the last show, it was the closer.
Holy shit.
And so, like, and you know, it's, like, a great... Like, he just has the ability to riff something that sounds like it's been all worked out, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And that's,
yeah.
like, that's kind of awesome. And, like, Patton does that, too, sometimes, where he just, like... He's just trying, he's just like figuring out a bit, but it's like has so many beats to it. And you're just like, oh my God, this sounds like it's been in, you know, that you've been working on this for 6 months, but it's just like this idea. Like, I don't know. I guess when you do it that long, you have the ability to sort of just let yourself go. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, it's awesome. And that's very, again, like, that's the world of like, that's one side of comedy that I love and cherish. But then, you know, Stephen Wright, I feel like, is the other end of the spectrum where it's like just someone who clearly is just sitting down writing jokes.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
that's the craft there is just
mm-hmm.
the writing of it. And I love those guys too. You know, I love hearing great jokes or even reading them. I mean, cause that's a lot of the time
sure.
that's happening on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, Stephen Wright would have an amazing Twitter account. That would be so awesome. But then, I don't know how you'd get compensated for that.
Right.
I'm glad he was able to make a living doing it this way.
It's, yeah, to be able to do that whole thing without without supporting yourself through banter and through
yeah.
being able to find your way to another joke, because there's no finding for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, it's an equal skill to exactly what you're talking about, being able to improvise something out of fucking nothing.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So, yeah, I feel like you've already condensed why to listen to this album, but if you want to give, like, two sentences, as if you've never heard Stephen Wright, and this is the only way you're going to find him somehow.
Well, the main reason is that, like, I think he kind of just did a very unusual thing, which is that he captured, with one album, he captured like the perfect Stephen Wright experience. Like, it's almost like he didn't need to make another album because this is everything you ever need. But it's like, it to me, it's just an amazing example of craft and consistency. You know, it's just like amazingly consistent in its funniness, and it goes all sorts of crazy different places, but it's, you know, it all kind of holds together, which is also something that you wouldn't necessarily think it could do, because it's mm-hmm. basically, like you said, it's just like one and two line jokes, but it does sort of, it's, I mean, he's like, his comedy is a world of its own, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, there's like, it's an alternate universe that he kind of created, and that's really, really hard to do when you're not, like, telling stories or creating characters. Yeah. Like, there are a couple of characters on the album that he's, like, sure. friends of his or whatever, and his girlfriend. But basically, he's just creating a world out of his unique perspective. And I think it's completely original, but it's also completely relatable, which, again, is a really neat trick that I think everybody aspires to.
Mm-hmm. That's perfect. All right. Twitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What should we...
I'm at Matt Belknap, and Never Not Funny is at Never Not Funny, and it's also on Facebook at facebook.com/NeverNotFunny. Mm-hmm. The website is NeverNotFunny.com. Mm-hmm. We're in our 16th season. We've had some really fun episodes recently with John Hamm and Andy Daly, Rich Sommer. Just stupid fun. We're having a really great time lately. For whatever reason, it's just getting sillier and sillier.
I just wanted to go buy something at that 7-Eleven just for the sake of it when I got here.
Yeah, listen to the Andy Daly episode if you just want to hear the stupidest, funniest thing that's probably ever happened on our show. Mm-hmm. That was really ridiculous and fun. So check it out. All right. It's on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. You can find Never Not Funny.
Are there releases from a special thing that people should have an eye out for that you can talk about, or have we talked about them all?
Yeah, I should say check out all the records that we've put out at mm-hmm. astrecords.com. Stuff coming up, Hampton Yunt, who am I not thinking of? Dave Hill, we have a Dave Hill album coming
out. Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that actually might be on vinyl, too. God, Ryan should actually be in here to talk about this stuff, because he's way more on top of stuff than I am, but... But yeah, look for those and mm-hmm. And the Greg Proops later this year, and hopefully we can get Andy Kindler out this year. That one's really taken a long time to cook in the oven, but it's going to be worth it when it comes out. So check those out, and then the stuff that's already out that you can enjoy today is like Paul F. Tompkins, Jen Kirkman, mm-hmm. Kyle Kinane's first record. I just gave you the CD of Jared Logan, which we did last year, which is so great. I love him. Mm-hmm. Karen Kilgariff. If you want stuff on vinyl, Karen Kilgariff is a guitar playing acoustic singer songwriter comedian who was also on Mr. Show. She's fantastic, and that's one of my favorite albums that maybe we ever did, mm-hmm. and that's on vinyl. Andy Peters is on vinyl. Andre Dubuchet, the Conan writer, who's super, speaking of weird guys who create their own world, he made an album of I lost track. It's 14, 15 different character sketches, character sketches that he recorded all over the country over a year or two.
That's amazing.
And that's on vinyl. That's called 20 Sided Guy. And that's amazing too. Yeah. So yeah, check it all out. It's all good.
Awesome. Well, thank you for doing this.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Letting me in, even though I was late. apologies again.
No problem.
Thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
yeah, it was... No, that wasn't me. Yesterday, I saw a subliminal advertising executive just for a second.